In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about the American Revolution. But the perspective we'll try to take is a little bit different than that we've taken in past programs. We'll try to take a look at the revolution from the British perspective. And that is the project that our guest here embarks on with his book, Iron Tears. The subtitle is America's Battle for Freedom, Britain's Quagmire, 1775 to 1783. It's published by the Free Press and by our guest this morning, Stanley Weintraub. He is Evan Pugh Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State University and is the author of a number of books dealing with World War I, II, Korea. He's written also about the American Revolution. He's written biographies. This book is just out now, technically it came out at the beginning of the year, so it has been out just a few months, a book that should be available in the bookstore near you if you'd like to take a look at it. And, of course, as we talk here this morning on Focus 580, questions are welcome. We would invite you to call in. All we ask of people who call is that they try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving. But, of course, anybody listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people with questions can call. Again, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. In and around Illinois and Indiana, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free. Or, in fact, if you would happen to be listening on the Internet, and we know there are people who do, and you'd like to call, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use that toll-free number. That is 800-222-9455. Professor Weintraub, hello.
Oh, good to be with you.
Thanks for talking to us. We certainly appreciate it. Perhaps a way to start out would be for me to ask you to talk a bit about what the colonies meant to Britain. And I'm thinking of having you do that in at least two ways. Maybe there are more than two. But the first would be to talk a little bit about their symbolic significance. To the British, how did the colonies connect to their image of empire?
We know the term the jewel in the crown, which has been applied to India as a result of television. But the jewel in the crown was actually invented to refer to America and the American colonies. They were King George III's jewel in his crown, the pride of the empire, and in particular a huge and growing market for British manufacturers. And it was exclusive. They had the right to send manufacturers over and to import raw materials to the detriment of any other country that was interested.
Hmm. Well, there you also touch on what would have been the second question, and that would be to look at what the colonies meant to the economy of Britain.
They meant a great deal to the economy, yet the British were very angry at American feelings that they were being mistreated because taxation was very low on the Americans and very high on the British. To the English, two sailing months across the Atlantic Ocean, the Americans who protested and wanted more freedom were only hypocrites and malcontents. Americans groaned about the burden of taxation, but the English bore the real financial burden. They even paid to protect the homes and the farms of colonists from the Indians. The cost of garrisoning America approached £300,000 a year at a time when wages for a laborer in England were a shilling a day, a 20th part of a pound. So you have to multiply by 20 and then about 20 again because of the difference in the value of money. The notorious tax on tea. Everybody remembers the Boston Tea Party. It so inflamed the Bostonians, but taxes on tea in America were only a fourth of what the English paid. Mm-hmm. And even Benjamin Franklin, who almost to the end hoped for accommodation with the British, labeled the Tea Party an act of piracy, and he urged compensation. The British were very unhappy looking at their own taxes. Americans paid very little, One London newspaper, just months after the Boston Tea Party, enumerated very unhappily what they were paying taxes on. They listed, and I can't remember them all, tax on land, poor tax, tavern licenses, taxes on tea, on coffee, on leather, on soap, on candles, on beeswax, on silver plate, even on rabbit hair for hats, on starch, on sugar, on tobacco, on window glass, on paint, on carriage wheels, on wine and spirits, on beer, cider, malt, salt, pepper, paper, writing quills, and ink. And although they paid all those taxes, the Americans not only didn't pay taxes on any of those products, they also evaded importing them from England by bootleggers who got them from places like Holland cheaper. So they really felt they had a gripe against the Americans.
Yeah, and I think that goes some way to explaining what is, I think, an overall kind of point that you make, and that is that if there was some major British mistake here, it was in failing to understand the way that the Americans thought, failing to estimate the depth of commitment to independence, failing to understand the way that they thought about the crown, failing to understand the way that they thought about the economic relationship between Britain and the colonies, and it was something that perhaps for a variety of reasons the British just didn't get.
They didn't get it in part because they didn't realize how fast America, the American colonies, were growing compared to Britain. Franklin, after the Battle of Bunker Hill, wrote to a friend in England who was a minister, but at the same time a sort of amateur economist. And he said, Britain, at the expense of £3 million, has killed 150 Yankees this campaign. And he figured that out as £20,000 a person. And he said, at Bunker Hill, Britain only gained a mile of ground. But during that very same time, 60,000 children have been born in America. And he said, from this data, your mathematical head will easily calculate the time and expense necessary to kill us all and conquer our whole territory. In other words, it was impossible. America was just outgrowing Britain.
Well, that also gets at a point that certainly there were people in Britain who appreciated, perhaps not enough, that was the fact that for a land area the size of America, with the amount of people, the idea that the British could manage to maintain hold of that by force, there certainly were people in Britain who said, look, this is just not possible. Just can't do this. And yet one wonders why that argument fell on so many deaf ears.
That's why I used the term as the title of my book, Iron Tears, because Edmund Burke, who was a member of Parliament and a famous political philosopher, claimed in Parliament that the British, in trying to subdue the unruly American colonies, were shedding iron tears. And he meant metaphorically cannonballs and musket shot. And sure enough, his metaphor for futility would turn into reality. And it's shown again on the cover of Iron Tears, in which you see the colonists tearing down a statue of George III. They did this up and down the colonies. Almost every courthouse had a statue. And when the Declaration of Independence was read, in 1776, it was read deliberately because a lot of people couldn't read. And so it was read to them from courthouse steps and church steps and so on. And if there was a handy statue of a Brit, usually the king, it got torn down. And the picture on the cover shows the tearing down of a statue in Bowling Green Park in Manhattan by the Sons of Liberty. It was a gilded lead statue of the king on a horse, and when the people tore it down, they broke it up into pieces, and they sent it to a factory in Connecticut, which was being run by women because the men were already at war. There it was melted down into bullets, and quite literally it was melted down into something like 42,000 bullets. So the Iron Tiers were being shot back at the enemy, the British.
To what extent was the conduct of the British, the course that they took?
I think the British generals are probably given a bad rap in part because the first ones sent over were really interested in conciliation. They didn't want to fight against the Americans. These were their own people, their cousins, in effect. And they preferred to try to end the war easily. But the Americans were just too stubborn. They didn't want to end the war. And finally, the British had to send over generals who seemed more ambitious to the people in London. And they were ambitious for glory, for increased rank. But when they came to America, they were befuddled by the distances you mentioned, the distances, the size, the sheer impossibility with 30 or 35,000 troops to put down a country that was 1,800 miles long along the Atlantic coast. And went inland so far into impenetrable wilderness that they couldn't do anything. The Americans could melt away, and then they could reappear again. They complained that Washington wasn't a good fighting general because he wasn't fighting pitched battles. His aim was to keep his small army together, and so they would disappear and reappear. There were very few battles.
Yeah. Well, that's I have seen it now written several times. Perhaps recently, this is because of the amount of writing there has been about George Washington. But have seen it said that the Washington, he didn't have to win; he only had to avoid losing.
That's right.
And he was in a much more a much easier sort of position, militarily speaking, than the British were, considering all that, and also the fact that it was an awful long way from they were an awful long way away from home.
I was once talking to an Iowa farmer about how much hay his horses ate in a month to try to figure out something about the logistics of the war. The British had to supply fodder for their and yet they couldn't get much fodder on the spot because the Americans would burn the fields. So they had to import their hay. I said, how much hay do your horses eat in a month? And I may get some objections from your listeners, but he told me that his horses eat about a ton of hay a month each. And I was baffled by that. That meant that the British had to send over hay, not only to feed the horses over here, but to feed the horses on board the ships that they were sending to America. And it took 2 months or more for the ships to cross the ocean. These were little sailing ships. Mm-hmm. That meant that by the time the fodder got across the Atlantic, it was gone. The horses had already eaten it. It just gives you some idea of the cost of fighting the war. The same thing was true with other provisions that they had to send over. If they sent over barrels of beer, the barrels of beer were drunk up by the time they arrived 2 months later. If they sent over food for the troops over here, much of the food was gone because the people on board ate it. So they had an almost impossible resupply situation.
Just going back to your comment that you thought maybe some of the British commanders got a bad rap, let me ask you to expand on that and to talk about their quality of soldiering. The British military leaders.
Well, there was a British General Howe and a British Admiral Howe who were brothers. Mm-hmm. They were both over here, and they were both given the license by the king to try to reach an agreement for conciliation. Now, they couldn't possibly fight a war and reach an agreement for conciliation unless they fought a rather muted war. Because then the Americans otherwise would be too angry to dicker with them. And so they in effect, pulled their punches for a while. Then the equivalent to our Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, was their secretary for America named Lord George Germain. He got very angry with them and got rid of them and put in another general. Well, the next general, Clinton, found that he had the same problems. Not only that, he found an accommodating mistress that he'd rather deal with than fight the war. And there were songs sung all over America about the idea that you had a general who spent more time in bed than on the battlefield. It wasn't easy to get somebody who wanted to fight a war. And the British never could find anybody to really do it, even though they fussed a lot about how good someone like General Cornwallis was. But Washington didn't win a war of strategy. He won a war, as you say, by not losing it. And people would complain about his indecision, about his inability to fight a pitched battle. Tom Paine, who was the great patriot, the American patriot, complained later on that Washington had been an ineffective general whose strategy consisted of doing nothing. But he did nothing very successfully. He did it so successfully, in fact, that on the few occasions when he surprised the British, as in crossing the Delaware and defeating mercenary soldiers, the Hessians, the British were so surprised that they really did not know what to do. And during that period, the French decided, well, we can get back at the British. They've beaten us before. They've taken away our lands in North America. Why don't we help out the Americans? Mm-hmm. And so Franklin was able to work out a financial agreement where the French lent the colonies money and provided troops and provided cannons and musketry that the Americans couldn't manufacture. And this was due to winning a few small skirmishes.
Earlier on, we talked a little bit about the British underestimating or failing to understand the depth of commitment to independence. Perhaps another mistake that they made was in their assessment of the military capabilities of George Washington, who and previous to the Revolution, I suppose, one might have been justified in thinking this would not be the greatest guy to have as the commander of the American forces. But that was certainly, he was not someone that they took particularly seriously as a threat, at least
early on. They not only didn't take him seriously, they wouldn't even call him general. They referred to him as Mr. Washington because they didn't recognize his rank as a general. In the French and Indian Wars, when he had been in the Virginia militia, he had risen to lieutenant colonel, but he lost every skirmish he was in. He was actually taken prisoner once, and at one point, because General Braddock was killed, he was an acting brigadier, in other words, an acting general, because they had nobody else. And when the American War began, that is the Revolution, Washington wanted to be the commander-in-chief and came to Philadelphia to the Continental Congress wearing his British general's uniform. Mm-hmm. In overt campaigning for the job. He held it only accidentally, but nevertheless, he was the only general in the colonies. And so they really had nobody else they could appoint. And yet his experience was really not of winning battles, but of losing them.
Yeah, I recall this recently reading a story about it at some point where the British military wanted to communicate with Washington, and they sent a letter to his military headquarters addressed to Mr. George Washington. And the guys at his headquarters said, no, there's no one by that name here. And they sent the letter back. And then the British said, okay. Then they sent the next letter addressed to George Washington Esquire.
Yes.
And that was also sent back. And it was not until they addressed it to General George Washington that the guys at Washington's headquarters would even accept the letter.
The whole point was that if they accepted Washington's rank as general, they accepted his appointment as general by the Continental Congress, and they considered the Continental Congress illegal, and therefore his rank was illegal, so they wouldn't accept him as general. But finally, I think it's a great irony that at the end of the war, after the battle of at the Battle of Yorktown, General Cornwallis had to surrender. He was boxed in, surrounded by both French and American troops. His artillery was all shot away. There was nothing he could do except surrender, and he sent a surrender message to the enemy. And General Rochambeau, the French general, wouldn't accept it because he wanted it to be accepted by the Americans. And finally, Cornwallis had to send a message to His Excellency General George Washington. And so they finally accepted Washington's rank when they were defeated at the very end of the war. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Stanley Weintraub. He is a professor emeritus of arts and humanities at Penn State University and is author of the book Iron Tears, America's Battle for Freedom, Britain's Quagmire, 1775 to 1783. It is an exploration of the American Revolution from the perspective of Britain. That's the idea of the book. It's published by the Free Press, has been out now for a few months. So if you're interested, you can seek it out. Questions are also welcome here on the program, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have someone here to bring into the conversation, someone listening in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Fascinated by the interview and by this particular period of history, and I'm glad you've written your book, Mr. Weintraub. In Ellis's biography of George Washington, he states that Washington was really put out with the British for not appointing him a regular commission in the British Army, and that it was made clear to him that he was subservient colonial of lesser status and would always be that way.
I think that I would disagree slightly on this, because the one who refused him an appointment was not anybody in the British Army. When he came back from having been a prisoner and having been defeated in the French and Indian Wars, he wanted to stay on in the militia. But it was the governor of Virginia who wouldn't reappoint him.
Okay.
This happens very often in wars, and I have to explain that to you. At the end of a war, troops are downsized. I mean, it happens after every war. It happened after World War II, for example. And you find the dilemma that somebody who had been a major general suddenly has to return to his permanent rank, which could be much lower than that. General Marshall, who was chief of staff of the American Army in World War II, at the end of the First World War, went from colonel to captain because he had to return to his original rank. And he didn't reach colonel again for about 18 years.
My point was that...
And Washington was being reduced from acting brigadier general to captain, quite literally. And he refused to accept it, and so he resigned from the Virginia militia.
Along that same line, I fully believe your facts are correct. Later in London, Isaacson describes Benjamin Franklin being chastised by the House of Commons. I forget that particular issue, but again. He paints the picture of the British government demanding that the American colonies be subservient components.
Yes.
Of the growing
that was
empire.
A very famous episode. It was known as the cockpit episode.
Yes.
For Franklin. Franklin was being chastised because he actually permitted private information about the governor, the royal governor of Massachusetts, to be published in the press. And he did this, although he was actually the deputy postmaster general for the colonies. In other words, he was doing something that was illegal and possibly unethical, and the British were charging him with this. And so they fired him as deputy postmaster general. And this was not only a financially lucrative job for Franklin, but it gave him a lot of access and a lot of opportunity to make appointments for his relatives. This is how his son, or illegitimate son William, became the royal governor of New Jersey through Franklin's connections. So they considered the Americans to be disloyal. And in a way, of course, they were disloyal. Franklin, till the very end, felt that we ought to have an accommodation with King George. Washington, until the First Continental Congress, thought there could be an accommodation. But they were outvoted by more radical members of the Continental Congress, who felt that we had outgrown Britain and they needed some excuse to break away. That doesn't make Washington or Franklin any less patriots.
Yes.
It's just they came around later.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have another caller here to talk with next, someone in Monticello on line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Your comments about the difficulties of the British supplying troops and getting supplies to the troops was reflected very much in Crisis 2 by Thomas Paine with this simple line. He said, "We conquer by a drawn game and you lose by it." It seems to me that every time a distant power tries to suppress an insurgency or a rebellion, that's what they run into. We found that out in Vietnam, and we're finding it out in Iraq.
I think we're finding it out in Iraq, and at the same time, once you get in, I use the word quagmire, Britain's quagmire,
right,
in the subtitle of Iron Tears. And when you get involved in an insurgency, you do get involved in a quagmire.
Yeah.
It's hard to get out.
That's one of my favorite lines from Thomas Paine. We conquer by a drawn game and you lose by it. That's what he said to General Howe.
Yeah. But later on, when Paine, after the French Revolution, was imprisoned in Paris, he tried to get Washington, who was then president, to extricate him and to use Washington's persuasive powers. And Washington didn't interfere. And as a result, Paine then began to castigate Washington as an inferior general and one who didn't do anything. But that was later on when he felt as if he had been ignored.
When you use a word like quagmire, as you do in the subtitle for the book, you know that people immediately will think about Vietnam. Do you think that there are important parallels between the British experience in America and the American experience in Vietnam?
I think because of technology, a lot of those differences disappear. For example, we have no trouble supplying troops. We can supply troops overnight. We have instant communication. Literally instant communication. I was visiting a friend recently whose son is a major stationed at the Baghdad airport. And while I was there, he got an email from his son telling him about a rocket attack, a mortar attack, on a post exchange at the Baghdad airport. That was instant. It took 5 or 6 days before that appeared in our newspapers because it was very carefully handled, and they announced there was one dead. It was actually a lot worse than that. But we can get instant communications that overreach the official communications of the government. The revolution, when Lord George Germain, who I mentioned was the Donald Rumsfeld of the revolution from the English side, sent orders on strategy to his generals over here, he had to send them by sailing ships against the wind, because the wind goes from west to east across the North Atlantic. And it took often 3 months before his orders got to the other side. Then they had to go inland. By that time, the issue was moot. In other words, the whole reason for his having sent those orders was gone. They had to provide orders half a year in advance in order to be able to do anything, and it became an impossible strategic situation. Today, we don't have that problem, just as we don't have the logistics problem. The problem that is similar is that if you don't have the loyalty of the people on the ground, then it's pretty hard to win a war. And we're finding that true in Iraq, just as the British found it in America. And there's a parallel.
Let's talk with someone else, someone listening this morning in Chicago. This would be line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Some years ago, my brother had a job in Canada just across the St. Lawrence River from Messina, New York. And he found there some of the people there still had hard feelings against the Americans for raids that were made during the Revolutionary War by a band or whatever you want to call them, an army led by Sullivan, these were either raiders or marauders or whatever. Anyhow, apparently they laid waste to a good part of the countryside. Do you have any information on that and the extent?
Oh, it was more than merely a raid. The Americans attacked Montreal and put Quebec to siege, and it was a difficult job for the British, and under General Carleton, for whom they now have named a university and other such things, they defeated the Americans. Benedict Arnold was one of the young generals who was up in Canada trying to acquire Canada. The Americans felt that they could, that if they were going to revolt against the British Empire, they should take all of North America with them. But the Canadians weren't interested. For some reason, the Canadians never felt any kind of sympathy with the American cause and were far more conservative with respect to the British Empire. And this was true again in the War of 1812, where the Americans tried to enter Canada, this time through Niagara and Niagara Falls area. And they were defeated, defeated on land, although they did win some battles on Lake Erie. The Canadians have never been interested, and one of the ironies that is involved in that is that at the end of the war, when Franklin was the negotiator for the Americans in the peace treaty, which was being worked on in Paris, Franklin tried to get Canada to be ceded to the new colonies, to be part of the United States. And the British didn't want to give up Canada. And one of the ways they prevented Canada from being given up is that they kept border forts in about eight places along the Great Lakes. And they refused to give up those border forts, and they said they would not give them up until there was a solid peace treaty with Americans paying the debts that were owed to them. And Franklin finally had to settle for giving up Canada. And so the British held on to Canada. One of the bargaining chips they used, and probably the most important one, was that the British held on to New York City, to Manhattan, and to Long Island, right throughout the war and into the peace. And it was only 2 years after the Battle of Yorktown that the British relinquished New York City, and Washington was able to move in. And they were holding that as a bargaining chip, and I would guess that we have New York City back because we relinquished the idea of Canada.
I was just wondering, why do you think there is still this hard feeling, if that apparently still exists? Was the land that my brother was referring to up in, across from Messina, New York, laid waste to such an extent?
I don't know why the Canadians have been so different, because there really wasn't much reason for it. But the Canadians never resented taxes. Many of the Canadians were quite conservative Quebecers who were French, and they weren't interested in becoming part of America. And maybe we're lucky that we didn't have a big French minority in that part of the country. It might have made for a different United States. But there had been a big difference, and the Canadians were a small population. That is, the Anglo-Saxon Canadians from England were a small population. And ironically, they became much bigger because of the loss of the 13 colonies. Many of the Loyalists felt they could not live in a free America that was free of George III, they wanted to be sent back to England. And the English didn't want to have to accommodate them and house them and pay for them. And so the British offered them land, free land in Canada, Nova Scotia in particular. But a lot of the Loyalists, disgruntled, but nevertheless wanting to be free of the colonies, went to Canada. So Canada has always had a different state of mind toward America. And even in the American Civil War, there was talk of the Americans trying to go back into Canada. And the British, in 1861 and 1862, sent additional forces over to Canada to protect them, though I don't think the Yankees had any cause to go into Canada, and I don't think they ever intended to.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. When the colonists in America laid out their grievances against the government of Britain, they specifically, personally, attacked the person of the king, George III. And to what extent was British conduct in America and commitment to the revolution a product of, let us say, personal feelings on the part of George III?
I'm not sure why George III was a villain to the Americans, other than that he represented the other side. In the Declaration of Independence, the only person actually mentioned by name, I think, is George III.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think he was mentioned is that he was actually the implicit father of the American colonies long before 1776. The Book of Common Prayer used in the colonies had mandatory prayers for him. And he was, by tradition, like his predecessors, the royal father of the kingdom and the empire. So he was symbolic of England. And many of the more conservative people in America resented the fact that they were being torn away from the king. As I said, that even the Book of Common Prayer required prayers to the king. And I live in Delaware, and in one town in Delaware south of where I am in Middletown, St. Anne's Church was closed down by the minister when the Declaration of Independence was read, because he said, without my being able to offer prayers to the king, I'm not going to keep the church open. And he literally padlocked the church, and it remained padlocked until 1783 when the peace treaty was signed. So George III was the father of the nation, and the Americans, in effect, were rebelling against their father.
And did he feel personally wounded by that?
Oh, he was. He was furious about it. He felt that he had been a benign, a benevolent king, and he thought this was a parasitical thing on the part of the Americans, a conspiracy of disloyalty to him. And so he got more and more rigid over the period of the Revolution, and he said he was determined, and I'm quoting him, to compel absolute submission. And he said, when faced with unruly children, what else should a father do?
Hmm.
And he thought, he looked at America as if he were the father of these children.
Let's take another caller. We have someone on the campus here of the university calling in on our line one. Hello.
Yeah, I was just wondering, could you flesh out what was involved with the Stamp Act? I've heard conflicting stories about that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
One of the few ways in which the British decided to symbolize parliamentary authority over the Americans, it was more than to raise money, was to symbolically have some mild taxes that would not hurt people, but hit them where they recognized they were being hit. And this was basically to ensure that they understood that Parliament was sovereign. Parliament had the ultimate authority over them. And that was the reason for the mild taxes on tea. And the Stamp Act was on legal papers, and on newspapers. And I guess we've had them over the years in this country, where the government has issued revenue stamps that you put on property transfers and so on. But the colonists described this as the intolerable acts, as if these small taxes literally were intolerable, and they were actually very mild. There was a sympathetic cartoon in London Magazine. I think it's one that I reprinted in Iron Tears, showing a young woman naked to the waist and wearing her hair Red Indian style to represent America being held down by bureaucrats, while Lord North, the Prime Minister, pours the contents of a teapot down her throat. And meanwhile, gripping her ankles to keep her rigid is the randy First Lord of the Admiralty, the Earl of Sandwich, who's peering up her skirts. And we know the Earl of Sandwich for having given a name to something we eat. But the whole idea of this cartoon was that although the Americans the Americans were really being enslaved by the British. But this was really not very true at all. And in many ways, they were hypocritical about it. The famous Dr. Johnson, the inventor of the first major dictionary, Samuel Johnson, wrote a pamphlet called Taxation, No Tyranny, in which he objected impatiently that Americans who appealed to abstract human rights while exploiting fellow human beings were guilty of sheer sophistry. He said, how is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the slave drivers of Negroes? And he pointed out that many of the so-called patriots owned slaves. And here we were claiming we wanted liberty. In England, there was no slavery anymore. In 1772, Chief Justice Lord Mansfield ruled that slavery, and I'm quoting him now, was too odious, is his word, to be acceptable under the laws of England. And as a result, any slave who came to England, who set foot on in England after 1772, was legally free. And so with his ruling, he effectively ended slavery in England, but it didn't affect the colonies. So here the colonies are clamoring for liberty, and in a state like South Carolina, there were more plantation slaves considered property than there were lawful people.
One of the people who was, and you just have just mentioned him in passing, who was certainly a key player on the British side of the British government in the revolution was the Prime Minister. Frederick North was his name, Lord North.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about him and how he contributed.
Lord North was basically loyal to the king. He was not a severe man. He wasn't interested in exacting retribution on the Americans. But he felt that as long as he was prime minister, he had to follow the duties dictated by the king. This is before reform legislation, which gave Parliament more power. The king had the power to do whatever he wanted, pretty much, until 1832 in the first Reform Act. So Lord North, when he didn't want to do what the king wanted, tried to resign. And the king said, I need you. You can't resign. And I'll do favors for you. He paid thousands of pounds of Lord North's debts, for example, in order to keep him as prime minister. He didn't want a more conciliatory prime minister. And I think Lord North was less conciliatory the more he got favors from the king. Finally, after Yorktown, he resigned and he refused to stay any longer. And the king had to appoint a more conciliatory prime minister who then arranged for negotiations with the Americans. Mm-hmm. But Lord North was really not a vicious man by any means, although cartoonists in American papers and in handouts that were sold for a penny around the country made him out to be a very odious figure.
And let me ask you about one other person here, and that is George Germain, who was the Secretary of State for America in the North Cabinet during the American Revolution.
He's the most fascinating figure, I think, in the whole group of Englishmen. And I'm glad you brought him up before our time ran out. Lord George Germain was the son of a duke, had become a general in the British Army, and a very legitimate general who won victories in Europe. But he was very angry at one point that a minor Prussian general, who was a cousin of Frederick the Great, was made his boss in a multinational army on the continent fighting the French. And he refused to follow the orders of Prince Ferdinand. The result was that Prince Ferdinand asked the king, who was then George II, George IV's grandfather, to court-martial him. And he was duly court-martialed and drummed out of the army, and drummed out of the army for cowardice, because he refused to follow the orders of Prince Ferdinand. The result of the court-martial was that he was not permitted to hold any rank in the army to command any army personnel further. But when he became Secretary for America under George III and became, in effect, the defense minister, he commanded generals again. He became a commander even more authoritative than he had been before he was court-martialed. So it's very strange that you have somebody court-martialed who then becomes the commander-in-chief of his army, in effect.
We are getting down to the point here where we have maybe 3 or 4 minutes, and I must apologize. We have a caller. I don't think we quite have time to take. But just as a way of trying to wrap up here, let me ask this question. Do you think that it would have been possible for Britain to have won the revolution?
No, I don't believe the British could have won the revolution. They had two generals who were not on their side. One was General Atlantic, the Atlantic Ocean. And the other I would have to call general demography, in other words, the burgeoning population of America. With general demography and General Atlantic against them, General Washington could win.
Lord North, after he left Prime Minister, did continue to have a political career. He was a member of Parliament. He was in the House of Lords. So he did have a political life afterwards. Lord Germain, I think his political career was ended by the revolution.
His career was ended by the revolution, but he made a deal with King George III to give him a title. Because he was a younger son, he was never going to become a duke. But he was made Viscount Sackville. He was of the famous Sackville family that still owns that huge estate south of London called Knoll, K-N-O-L-E, which Virginia Woolf wrote about in her novel Orlando about the Sackvilles. And he became Viscount Sackville. He sat in the House of Lords. But he only lived a few more years after that, and he had no more career.
Well, when you look at those people who were important either in the government or in the military at the time, were most people effectively damaged for life, politically speaking, because of the experience?
What often happens with the dismissed generals is that they get raised a rank or two in compensation, and some of them got higher ranks. Hmm. The only one who got a higher rank who really deserved it was General Cornwallis. General Cornwallis went to India, conquered a good deal of India and the Indian princely states for the British, and he became Earl Cornwallis. And so he legitimately became a hero after he lost at Yorktown.
Mm-hmm. Just perhaps one final question, and I don't know if this is too complicated to ask at this point where I could only give you a minute or so to answer, but and that generally has to do with the nature of the American Revolution and its nature and extent. And I gather that among historians, there's actually some debate and conversation about just how revolutionary was the revolution.
That debate is going to continue. The revolution turned out to be a lot more conservative than one thought it was, because we didn't have one man, one vote as a result. We had a republic. We had representative government, even to the point where we still don't elect a president. We elect electors in the various states who then vote for president. So we have 531 or 32 electors that elect the president quite officially. So we still have an indirect democracy, and that's part of the conservatism that resulted in the Constitution that was settled on after the war.
Well, there we must leave it with our thanks to our guest, Stanley Weintraub. The book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Iron Tears. It's published by the Free Press. Stanley Weintraub has written many books. He's written about the Revolution, about World War I and II and Korea. He's written biographies of many different individuals, including Benjamin Disraeli, James McNeill Whistler, Queen Victoria, Aubrey Beardsley. So if you're interested, you can seek out some of his books. Go down to the bookstore or to the library. Stanley Weintraub is Evan Hugh, Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State. And Professor Weintraub, thank you.
You're welcome. Glad to have been with you.